Howdy. Greg Swan here from selfadoration.com. I wrote a book called Man Alive, a Survival Manual for the Human Mind. And I try to make time every Sunday to talk about issues of self-adoration. Today is Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day, Mom. My mother will not see this because my mother is a Luddite. Does not believe in technology in any form. She has a cell phone now, finally, at last, but it's a dumb cell phone. It's not a smartphone, so I cannot send email to my mother. Every once in a while, I will print something out for her and mail it to her, a snail mail, so she'll see it 3 or 4 days later. But needless to say, we have our Mother's Day card to him already. Thank goodness my wife, Kathleen Collins, takes care of this stuff because I could never remember to get it done in a timely fashion. She'd get her Mother's Day card next Thursday if it were up to me to send it. But happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there. And it's a matter of importance to me to acknowledge the gifts that we have from our parents. The baby boom generation in particular is very quick to criticize parents for the mistakes that they made. Well, I've got news for you. There are no parents who haven't made mistakes. All parents make mistakes. But the chances are excellent if you're able to get this video, the chances are absolutely excellent that your parents did a phenomenal job with you, that they may have made some few mistakes, but in every respect that matters, putting a roof over your head, putting food on the table, putting clothes on your back, getting you an education, making sure that you lived up to your moral obligations before you were able to see in your own behalf why that was important, your parents took care of all of that. And the most important gift they gave you, absolutely the most important gift they gave you, was the gift of father tongue, the gift of mind, which I talk about all through Man Alive, because it's what distinguishes us as things. Human beings are distinguished from all other organisms because of father tongue, because we reason and choose in concepts. And there is nothing like this in the animal kingdom, certainly not among the higher animals, and obviously among, you know, fish, plants, bugs, single-celled organisms. They're nothing at all like us. And this is one of my huge arguments with the world of academia in general right now, is this insistence on conflating human conceptual cognition, human rationality, conflating that with animal behavior. There are interesting things about animals. I talk about my dogs all the time because I learn so much about how minds work, how brains work, not minds, because mind is a conceptual creation. An animal doesn't have a mind. All it has is a brain. But I learn a lot about how brains work by watching my dogs and watching other animals. But I don't learn very much about how human beings behave from animals, because human behavior is conceptual in origin. It is not genetic in origin. It is not driven by brain chemistry or hormones or financial circumstances or memes or any of the other non-conceptual influences that people want to cite. These things are easy for scientists to study. Particularly, they're easy to study with lab animals, because human subjects are difficult to work with, are expensive to work with, and there are all kinds of ethical protocols that you have to live up to if you're going to work with human subjects, whereas if you're going to work with lab animals, all you have to do is keep the people for the ethical treatment of animals off your back. And the way you keep them off your back is by writing them a check. It's real easy. You can buy off any pressure group with a check. But human beings are unique, and our consciousness is unique. Our style of consciousness is unique. Our ability to reason and choose about conceptual information is absolutely unprecedented in the universe, and conflating us with any other thing is almost always an error. That if we're going to talk about our susceptibility to gravitation, then I'm no different from a dog in that respect. But that doesn't mean that the dog can sign a lease or write one or pay the rent on time. These are attributes that would only make sense with respect to human consciousness, and it's a bright line distinction. It is a huge, vast chasm of difference, and really, frankly, the biggest difference of all is the idea of the self, which is why I'm talking about self-adoration, because the self is the most important idea in your life, and it is an idea that number one, you don't share in any way at all with animals. Animals don't have anything at all like this. Animals have no self-consciousness, no consciousness of their life as a life in any way whatever. But you don't share the self with anyone else either. This is an idea that you abstract iteratively, alone, inside your own mind. And you experience that idea alone, in solitude. It is the idea with which you are most constantly thinking about, almost exclusively thinking about it. And everyone else is in the same situation as you. They're all, each one of those individual people is thinking about his own self and working on his own self and navigating his life by reference to this moral lodestone, this idea. But each one of us is doing it alone. We cannot share this experience. We cannot share introspective consciousness with another person. If you really get to know another person, know them inside and out, I mean, see them in hundreds of circumstances over a lot of time, then you can fairly reliably predict that person's behavior. And the time you spend together can have a degree of communion that feels almost supernatural to you, but it isn't supernatural. It isn't that way at all. And there may be, here we have chemical cues that may be helping you feel this way, like oxytocin, the love drug, the love hormone. You snuggle up with your best beloved, with your spouse or your lover, and the process of snuggling releases oxytocin, and you both feel better. It's the same thing that moms feel with new babies. It's that feeling of infinite love. This is a chemical reaction. I understand that. And that doesn't mean that you're not a reasoning animal. To the contrary, it just means that you have the ability to reason, but you are still an animal. And this is a huge source of stupid conflicts in philosophy. I don't think they're really stupid. I think they're intentional. But in any case, the arguments end up being very stupid because you either insist that humanity is all, I don't know what word to use because the words are all confusing. I use the word self, but I'm talking about a real idea. If someone uses the word soul, they may or may not be talking about what I'm talking about. And I, you know, at that point, I really have to ask a lot of questions to find out what it is that we're talking about. But on the one hand, you have people who insist that human life is all about soul. It's all soul. And on the other hand, you have especially scientists, especially academics, insisting that human beings are basically just robots. We're just big machines. And the same causal principles that affect the sands on the beach or the stars in their orbits account for causality in human beings. And I don't have any opinion about this at all. And I really don't care about human behavior at that level of abstraction. I don't believe that the scientific explanation is adequate. I think that there's a whole lot of hand-waving in between the orbits of stars and the behavior of any willful 17-year-old kid. And I don't believe that any of those academics, number one, I don't believe that they can explain human behavior in mechanistic terms. I don't believe anyone can explain human behavior except by the means that I've outlined, and it's basically just an outline. It's a beginning. It's not the end. Human behavior is caused by cognition. It's caused by thinking. And we think in father tongue. We think in words. We think in concepts. And so any genetic Homo sapiens that does not have the power of father tongue, that has in whom has not been cultivated the gift of mind, that genetic Homo sapiens can't reason and cannot choose because it can't think. And we can only think in words, and therefore all of our complex behaviors, all of our purposive behaviors, all of our goal-seeking behaviors are going to be completely conceptual and theoretically defensible in reason. It doesn't mean that any particular person will have thought out the rational arguments behind what they're doing to any high degree of rigor, but anytime you run into a person who's doing something you don't understand, you can say, hey, why the heck are you doing that? And you should be able to get an answer in words that you can understand. And the explanation may not make sense to you, but it doesn't really have to. It has to make sense to the person who's acting. This person is acting in pursuit of his own goals and values, and the reason he gives for you is all the reason he needs. This is the way we are made. This is everything I'm talking about here is teleology. Teleology is shoulding, is choosing, is goal pursuit, value pursuit. Teleology is the branch of philosophy concerned with ultimate ends, and that's a great big and fancy way of saying, why are you doing what you're doing? In the service of what goal? And toward what purpose? What objective are you seeking? What circumstance will define success when you're finished. And so much of what you will hear if you listen to other people talk about teleology, if you listen to them talk about what you must or should do, I consider dead-end teleologies. There are teleologies that have no, that offer no benefit whatever to the uniquely human life. And the one that I'm citing here, I mean, it's a zillion different names in science, but it all basically boils down to determinism, to the idea that human behavior is unavoidable. It's caused by some physical cause or some goad outside of free will, outside of the idea of the will, and that therefore consciousness is an illusion. We can do math on this if you like. Consciousness easily would be defined as a number one, a positive value. It's a positive value on the number line. Illusion, plausibly, unless you're pursuing it for entertainment purposes, is a negative, or at least a zero, at best a zero. And so if you say consciousness is an illusion, what you're saying is one equals zero. You have arrived at a contradiction. And the fact that the statement is contradictory doesn't mean that the claim is untrue, although the claimant rationally cannot make it. It doesn't mean that the claim is untrue, but it does mean that the claim is hugely suspect, because if in reality consciousness is an illusion, then there is nothing that anyone can say, including consciousness is an illusion. Any statement that anyone makes is equally arbitrary as the barking of a dog. It doesn't mean anything whatever. And if the statement is false, if it does not accurately reflect reality, then whatever consciousness is, we know that it is not illusion. And obviously nobody behaves that way, and that's why it's a dead-end teleology. There are others that you could name, like fatalism or solipsism. Solipsism is a belief that the entire universe is a creation of my imagination. I cited in Chapter 8 of Man Alive, I cited the multiverse idea, M-theory, string theory, used to be called the many-worlds theory of quantum mechanics. The argument being that there are 10 to the 500th power universes, of which we have physical evidence of precisely one, the one that we live in. And so all of the rest are postulated. They're hypothesized. And they're hypothesized because the math works. And so what that really says is the map supersedes the territory. The empirical evidence that we have of the territory consists of the evidence of this one universe, and really only a little bit of it, the little bit of it that we've seen so far, which is not very much at all. We have that as empirical evidence, and meanwhile we have equations that are fruitful for somebody's purposes if you postulate an enormous number of universes up to 10 to the 500th power universes. That's a map. And the insistence in this case, as with determinism, as with many other academic philosophical theories of unreality, is that the map supersedes the territory, that when the territory does not correspond with the map, then you don't throw away the map, you throw away the territory, which is an epistemological error. It's just stupid. It's dumb. And all of these ideas are dumb. I mean, the ultimate dead-end teleology, as far as I'm concerned, is the Matrix. And this is, you know, we need Tommy Chong to tell us, hey, man, what if we're all living in the Matrix? And, you know, there are people who say that. They will say, there are people who, there's nothing so stupid that you can't find someone who will say it. And that's not really the problem. It's not the, saying it is not the problem. The problem is following through. Do you follow through on that idea? Do you live your life as if you are an involuntary power supply for a malevolent supercomputer? Well, actually, some people do live that way. They live their lives as aquatic plants. And my question for them would be, hey, how's that working out for you? How many of your life's goals have you achieved by sitting around doing nothing? How many wonderful ideas have you managed to master by doing nothing with your life? And the reality is that advocates of dead-end teleologies, and religion would be another one, I mean, there are no limits to the number of different ways that people can say you should do what you obviously should not do. You should do what I don't do, which is what they really say, because anyone who says that human behavior is determined and therefore cannot be influenced by an act of will, nevertheless, those people all have luggage tags. They all have their name and address on their luggage. If they have dogs, I promise you, they have house-trained their dogs. Why would you house-train your dog? I mean, you're insisting that human behavior can't be influenced by an act of will. Why would you ever suppose that a dog's behavior could be influenced by an act of will? But obviously, we all house train our dogs, unless we force our dogs to live outside, which is another kind of cruelty. We all provide cat boxes for our cats, and the cats gleefully use those cat boxes, even though they would happily, you know, shit on the carpet if there were no cat box. We raise our children and we carefully inculcate our children in the ideas of virtue, and we punish them when they fail and we reward them when they succeed. And in due course, they learn on their own why good behavior results in self-adoration and bad behavior results in self-loathing. And we do all of this all the time. Nobody ever, ever, ever says, well, jeepers, there's no way that anyone could ever keep track of my luggage because consciousness is an illusion, so there's just no point in putting my name on my luggage. If it gets lost, it just gets lost. Nobody says that. Nobody lives that way. And because they don't live that way, you need to make a distinction whenever you're listening to an argument like this. Nobody actually lives his life that way. The argument in Man Alive, in the end, I give you three words: ontologically consonant teleology. And if that's not a mouthful, then you need to find a better book. But by being ontologically consonant, teleology is shooting, ontology is being. Ontologically consonant means in consonance with reality, with the way reality really is. And but what I mean by reality is existential reality. I do not mean subjunctive quibbling, which is what all of this stuff boils down to. Is you get, oh, but what if you hypothesize a super intelligent robot? How would you know if it had free will or not? Well, my answer is produce the robot. I'm not interested in talking about a hypothetical robot until you can produce it, evince it, put it in front of me, and then I'll worry about whether or not it's intelligent or not. And I'll tell you how I will start the test. If you really want to hypothesize about this, I'll start the test by cheating it. I will cheat it again and again and again, and if it doesn't bitch about being cheated, then I know it's not intelligent. And if it does, that's not proof that it is intelligent, but at least I've, I have an excellent chance of eliminating. I mean, go cheat Eliza. Eliza is allegedly this is artificial intelligence, and it's another dancing bear theory. Dancing bear theories are discussed in the book. It's the equation of human consciousness with animal consciousness. Dancing bears are just as smart as us, and artificial intelligence is a dancing bear theory. There is no such thing as artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence is canned human intelligence. When you interact with software, you are interacting with the programmers of that software, and there is no other source of intelligence in that system. It's either the data that you put into the software or the data and programming that the programmers built into the software originally. But there is no such thing as artificial intelligence, and I'm prepared to argue that there may never be such a thing. Certainly none of the theories that are being pursued right now will do anything except give us more and more elaborate systems of canned human intelligence. Yet another dead-end teleology, and this is all absurd. It's useless. It's completely teleologically useless. Whereas, if you take account of your real life, as you really live it, in existential reality, and figure out which side of the bread has the butter on it, then pursue that value, pursue the positive value and not the negative value, then your life will improve. And then at that point you have to say, what is the value to me of holding this idea in my mind, this anti-ontological, this dis-ontological teleology? What is the value of holding that in my mind? I would say that it's a net dis-value. It's not a value at all, because you're introducing cognitive dissonance into your mind. Cognitive dissonance means simultaneously holding two contradictory ideas in your mind. One equals zero. And you cannot actually do that. I mean, you know, you can try, and people destroy their lives trying, but all the time, all of your conscious effort, or a huge amount of your conscious effort, will be devoted to shouting your own self down, that you hold this contradictory idea in your mind, this idea that contradicts your everyday existential experience, and then every time experience rubs your nose in the fact that your theory is wrong, you have to shout experience down. You have to dispose of the territory in order to conserve the map. And this is an error. I mean, this is a huge error. We've been talking about philosophical errors for weeks now. I think this is 4 or 5 weeks that I've been doing this. This is a massively consequential error. This is a virtually insuperable error. You really have to correct this. Everyone has to correct this one way or another. And if you are wise, you will conform your theories and your behavior to the reality that you actually live in. And if you are unwise, ultimately that reality will destroy you. Because you cannot make war on your mind indefinitely eventually you have to win that war. Eventually you have to succeed. And this is cognitive dissonance. I mean, a thousand different flavors of it, a million different flavors of it. But it really is what I said. It's holding two contradictory ideas in your mind at the same time. 1 = 0, 6 = 9. It is devastating. It is hugely self-destructive. And if you indulge in it, you will destroy yourself. You will destroy yourself, the idea that I'm talking about. And I don't mean literally necessarily completely obliterating yourself, but you will, the consequence of making war on your mind is you will become less and less adept, less and less competent, less and less confident, less and less competent to live a self-adoring life. I mean, the consequence of self-destruction is self-loathing. I call it squalor. It's the opposite of splendor is squalor. And cognitive dissonance is the means by which you pursue squalor. I'll give you an example that I thought was really interesting. This happened, I saw in the newspaper years ago. A guy is having a fight with his wife, and he turns around and punches the television, destroys the television by punching it. And this is the guy attempting to argue to himself that he's not a wife beater, that he's just a television beater. And this is a completely false. I mean, it was the intent was to intimidate his wife just as if he had hit her, but he hit the television instead. This is the kind of lie that people tell themselves that will ultimately result in, you know, massive, massive, massive self-destruction. I had 4 topics that I wanted to take up, and so far I've only done one, and I've been talking for almost 22 minutes. So obviously we're not going to get to 4 topics today. One other idea that I thought was really interesting that came up this week. I did a lot of video this week, and I ended up not writing very much because I had other things going on. I'm working on a book and not sleeping very much and juggling a lot of eggs. But Brian Brady, my friend Brian Brady, asked me a question about what kind of organizations are best at promoting the idea of self-adoration the way I think about it. And he cited an article that was in the Wall Street Journal about Brett Stevens wrote an article about to high school or to college graduates telling them to try to learn something useful before they go out and get a job because they've just wasted 16 years of their lives getting no education, whatever. But he cited an intern that he had had who was a second lieutenant in the Army and was a real go-getter, was really top-notch. And Brian mentioned that a lot of people that we admire, a lot of people that we think are very interesting in the world out there now, have a military background. And so do I think that the military is a good source of learning the habits of mind that result in self-adoration? No, I do not. I do not. Nor schools, obviously not colleges. There's no organization that I could think of that is going to promote the kind of ideas that I'm interested in, because they're completely antithetical to the interests of organizations. An organization is a herd. It's a herd of sheep. And I'm not saying that all of the individuals who belong to that organization are sheep. To the contrary, but from the point of view of the shepherds, those are the sheep. And what is the number one job of a shepherd? The number one job of a shepherd is to hang on to the sheep. And any organization that you could name is going to do whatever it takes to preserve its own ongoing success as a herder of sheep. It is not going to do anything to encourage any ideas of independence or self-reliance in the people who belong to that organization. To the contrary, it's going to discourage those ideas in every way. And if someone gets to be a little bit too rebellious, they're either going to be punished or expelled from the group. That's what happens. And so the intern that Brett Stevens was talking about was the exception, not the rule. And the people that Brian and I know who we think are very admirable people, they're the exception and not the rule. They were probably that way before they got there. And I'm not implying that people can't learn the kind of ideas that I'm talking about. I know they can. But they're not going to learn them in any kind of an organization, even an organization that is putatively devoted to the idea of self-adoration. Organization theory is a branch of, I don't know what it is, I guess a branch of political science or psychology or maybe the intersection of the two. But organizational theory very competently argues that organizations exist for their own purposes and especially to grow all out of proportion to any possible need that they might fulfill, that that's what they do. That a group is going to sustain itself. And so he mentioned the Jesuits, and I think a Jesuit education is a wonderful thing for a child. If you can get your kid into a really good Jesuit school, especially a Jesuit high school, please do. It will, your kid will learn amazing, amazing things, things they would not learn in any other high school. But the Jesuits themselves are hugely communist. I mean, I don't want to put a percentage on it, but at least a majority of the brothers, of the members of the Society of Jesus, are communist, actual red Marxists. And the organization encourages that kind of Marxism. The same thing for orders of nuns or labor unions or military cadres or offices, job sites where people work together. These all become like families. And there's nothing wrong with the family. And one of the things that you'll do that will happen if you say something about communism is that, you know, you don't have to talk against communism for very long to get some dipshit undergraduate show up and say, but what about the family? The family is perfect communism in action. I'll tell you what, the family isn't perfect communism. The family is a perfect family. And the reason that the family works is that the to each don't even know that the from each are giving up so much. And hear it again, it's Mother's Day. You want to talk about from each? Your mom sweat, bled, screamed in agony for 30 hours giving birth to you. Why the hell did she do that? What was she thinking? You ungrateful wretch. But the parents in a family give for years on end before they get anything in return, anything other than a smile and a giggle and a pile of dirty socks and undone chores and massive complaints about everything. They give, and that's why it works. And this is why communism doesn't work, because the people who are going to have to do the from each get sick of it after a while. Why should they go through all that agony? Why should I go through all that and not get a Mother's Day card, for Christ's sake? Not to say that a Mother's Day card is anything like the compensation that your parents are due, but it's what you're going to give them. A Mother's Day card and dinner out. But organizations like the Society of Jesus or like a military platoon or like an office, those groups of people come to be like families. And especially people who are, you know, high S in the DIS system, really social, really interested in social relationships, those people come to prize the relationships more than anything else, more than the putative objectives of the group. And the reason that you find so many communists among Jesuits is that they live in a state of communism. That's the way their communities work. That's the way they all live together. They live together and they all work together and everybody contributes and everybody benefits. And heck, it works for us. Why can't it work for everybody? Well, it won't work for people who do not identify a greater benefit in the community than they do in their own individual pursuits of their values. And if you're going to coerce people into sacrificing their values for your sake, you have to expect that they're going to reject that. And I don't see any way around this in the way of organizations, that the individual who wants to do better, who wants to achieve self-adoration, is really going to have to do it pretty much alone. I mean, I can help and other people can help, and I do a lot in the way of providing links to offsite resources for things, places where you can go to improve your mind. And obviously, much of what I write is about intellectual self-defense, about defending yourself against dominance games by other people. But this is pretty much something that you're going to have to do alone, because any organization that you're going to be involved with is going to be serving its own ends, which are anti-individualistic, which are completely opposed to your goals as a self. And when your goals as a self come into conflict with that group's objectives, that group is either going to punish you or purge you. That's the only options that it has. That's the only way the group itself can survive. And frankly, my argument would be to you that, you know, put not your faith in princes, put not your faith in groups. Do not look to groups to solve anything for you. Other than, you know, self-selected groups like your family, where everybody, or at least everybody who has any power to make a decision, is pursuing the common interests of the group rather than what might be the particular interests of that one individual. If you're not in a group where everyone is committed to the good of all, then that group eventually is going to turn on you. And when it turns on you, then you're going to have to decide what matters more to you, your sovereignty or your membership in that group. And my argument would be, your sovereignty matters far more, but that's not a decision I can make for you. I'm not going to should you about this, because it's something that you have to decide for yourself in the context of your own values. I have so much more that I'm not getting to, and so I'm just going to let it go. I'll either take it up next week or I'll do something else. August 21st, 2013, will be 500 days from the publication of Man Alive. The book was released on April 8th, 2012, which was Easter Sunday, and 500 days from that is August 21st, 2013. And so I'm going to call that Splendor Day. And I don't know that we can take over the world in 500 days, but I'm not prepared to relinquish that goal until I... probably not until the day before. If we don't make it by the day before, I may be willing to say, okay, probably not going to happen tomorrow. But I believe we can do this. I believe that if you are committed to your values and you're willing to do whatever it takes to achieve those values, and if you are willing to share these ideas with your friends, with your family, with your neighbors, with the people that you work with, and if they are willing to commit to their values in the same way that you commit to yours, and if everybody is sharing these ideas as far and as wide as they can, as quickly as they possibly can, then I don't see any reason in the world why we cannot take the world back in 500 days, to get the world back to a position where each individual person is focused on his own values, his own personal values, and his goals and ambitions for his family and for his friends and for everyone that he knows. There's no reason in the world that we shouldn't be able to do this. And so let's call it Splendor Day, August 21st. 2013, and I'm enlisting you. I'm enlisting you not in my cause, I'm enlisting you in your cause, but I'm enlisting you, and I'm saying, if you will commit to this, and if you will work to make this happen, I will do everything I can to make it happen, and if you work the way that I'm working, and if we all work this way, if we all work toward our own values, then in 500 days, in less than 500 days, 500 minus 35, so 465 days, we could be living in a different world. We could be living in a world where our potential is limitless. Our potential is unlimited. And that this is true. This is the truth of human reality. The purpose, I think, of all of those dead-end teleologies is to convince you of the contrary, that you're fundamentally defective, that you're botched by design. And what creation in nature, what thing, what artifact of nature is botched by design? To the contrary, everything in nature is perfect. And nature achieves, I mean, this is what natural selection achieves, is a greater and greater state of perfection. Why should we among organisms be the only thing that's botched? And why should everything about us be botched? It's not. To the contrary, we are capable of extreme moral perfection. We are capable of doing everything wisely and well. And all we have to do is master it, is learn how. And I want to do it in my own life. It's something that I do every day. And I'm not perfect at it. No, you know, you're always going to make mistakes. And if you insist that you can't make mistakes, that perfection is not a goal worthy of pursuit because sometimes you're going to make mistakes, well, then that's just retarded. It's the same thing as saying that you shouldn't learn how to play guitar. You shouldn't learn how to drive. You shouldn't learn how to read. You shouldn't learn anything because you're going to make mistakes. Well, that's ridiculous. It's stupid. And obviously, you know it's stupid in every everyday manifestation of your life. And so why wouldn't you apply that same standard to your ethical systems, to your moral life? And that's what I'm talking about, and that's what we're going to do together. Everybody who does it with me, everybody not with me as in a group, but just side by side, we work in concert with each other. Everybody who does that with me is gonna achieve better results in their life. They're gonna have a better life. They're gonna have a better, happier life. And frankly, the memories that you accumulate from this process will be precious to you, because you will see yourself at your best. You will see your best possible self. And you will never, never, never tire of seeing your best possible self. I'm in the splendor business. I have an infinite quantity, and I want you to share it in. My name is Greg Swan. The site is selfadoration.com. The book is Man Alive, a survival manual for the human mind. Read it, internalize it, master it, put it into practice, and everything will be better in your life. Bless you. Thank you so much. Happy Mother's Day.